cast Lincoln as a radical, bent on abolishing all distinctions between the races. The question of black equality, in the modern sense, was not controversial in Illinois, or in the nation as a whole. Almost every white man was against it, even most abolitionists. Douglas was certain that no candidate who professed a belief in the social or political equality of blacks and whites could possibly carry Illinois, where a long-standing set of black laws prevented blacks from voting, holding political office, giving testimony against whites, and sitting on juries. At every forum, therefore, Douglas missed no opportunity to portray Lincoln as a Negro-loving agitator bent on debasing white society. "If you desire Negro citizenship," Douglas baited his audience, "if you desire them to vote on an equality with yourselves, and to make them eligible to office, to serve on juries, and to adjudge your rights, then support Mr. Lincoln and the Black Republican Party." The crowd responded as Douglas hoped. "Never! Never!" Cheers nearly drowned out his voice as he shouted his opinion that the signers of the Declaration of Independence had no reference to Negroes at all when they declared all men to be created equal. They did not mean Negro, nor the savage Indians, nor the Fiji Islanders, nor any other barbarous race. They were speaking of white men. "I hold that this government was established for the benefit of white men and their posterity forever, and should be administered by white men and none others." Cries of "That's the truth!" erupted from the agitated throng amid raucous applause. In response, Lincoln avowed that he had no purpose to introduce political and social equality between the white and the black races. He had never been in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry. He acknowledged a physical difference between the two that would probably forever forbid their living together upon the footing of perfect equality. But notwithstanding all this, he said, taking direct aim at the Supreme Court's decision in the Dred Scott case, there is no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all the natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence. I agree with Judge Douglas. He is not my equal in many respects, certainly not in color, perhaps not in moral and intellectual endowment, but in the right to eat the bread without leave of anybody else, which his own hand earns. He is my equal, and the equal of Judge Douglas, and the equal of every living man. It is instructive, political philosopher Harry Jaffa perceptively notes, that the only unequivocal statement of white supremacy Lincoln ever made was as to color, the assertion of an obvious difference. Had he advocated political and social equality for blacks, he unquestionably would have lost the election in a state where the legislature not only supported the discriminatory black laws, but had gone even further by passing a special law making it a criminal offense to bring into the boundaries of Illinois a person having in him one-fourth Negro blood, whether free or slave. And this same law essentially barred blacks and mulattoes from entering the state to take up residence. Nonetheless, Lincoln's implied support for the black laws stands in contrast to the bolder positions adopted by both Seward and Chase. Chase had long since adopted a liberal stance on race, far in advance of the general public, and had been instrumental in removing some but not all of Ohio's discriminatory black laws. Seward, too, had spoken out vehemently against the black laws and in favor of black suffrage, coming from the more progressive state of New York. However, neither Seward nor Chase advocated full social and political equality for blacks. Seward did not believe, his biographer concludes, that the black man in America was the equal of the white, or that he was capable of assimilation, as were the Irish and German immigrants. but he did believe that the Negro was a man, and as such deserved and should have all the privileges of the whites. Nor did Salmon Chase think that the two races could live together. He told Frederick Douglass that he thought separation was in everyone's best interests. He believed that blacks would find happier homes in other lands. So long as they were here, however, he championed measures to fight discrimination. These statements of Seward and Chase, coming from the leaders of the anti-slavery cause, reveal that racism, the belief in white supremacy, was deeply embedded in the entire country. It is only in this context that the statements of Lincoln and his contemporaries can be judged. Less than two decades earlier, Alexis de Tocqueville, who was deeply opposed to slavery and believed emancipation to be inevitable, had written, "The most dreadful of all the evils that threaten the future of the United States arises from the presence of blacks on its soil. Even in the states where slavery had been eradicated and where suffrage had been granted," he observed, "countless obstacles had been placed in the way of the black man. If he presents himself to vote, he runs a risk to his life. Oppressed, he can complain, but he finds only whites among his judges. His son is excluded from the school where the descendants of Europeans come to be instructed. In theaters, he cannot buy for the price of gold the right to be placed at the side of one who was his master. In hospitals, he lies apart. The black is permitted to beseech the same God as whites, but not to pray to him at the same altar. He has his own priests and churches. One does not close the doors of heaven to him. Yet inequality hardly stops at the boundary of the other world. When the Negro is no longer, his bones are cast to one side, and the difference of conditions is still found even in the equality of death." Even when abolition should come, Tocqueville predicted, Americans would have still to destroy three prejudices much more intangible and more tenacious than it: the prejudice of the master, the prejudice of race, and finally, the prejudice of the white. The dilemma faced by advocates of emancipation was the place of free blacks in American society. The opposition to assimilation was almost universal. Blacks were already barred from entering the borders of many free states. Confronting such barriers, "What, in the name of humanity," Henry Clay asked, "is to become of them? Where are they to go?" "My first impulse," Lincoln had said before, "would be to free all the slaves and send them to Liberia, to their own native land." Lincoln had long supported the same implausible plan endorsed by Edward Bates and Henry Clay, the notion of compensating slave owners and returning freed slaves to their homeland. Without such a program, colonizers argued, Southern whites would never accept the idea of emancipation. Still, Lincoln took note of the staggering administrative and economic difficulties. More than 3 million blacks lived in the South, representing 35% of the entire Southern population. The overwhelming majority had no desire to go to Africa, and only a few spokesmen, not including Lincoln, advocated forced deportation. They were here to stay. "What then?" Lincoln asked. "Free them all and keep them among us as underlings? Is it quite certain that this betters their condition?" But once freed, could they be made, politically and socially, our equals? My own feelings will not admit of this, and if mine would, we well know that those of the great mass of white people will not. Whether this feeling accords with justice and sound judgment is not the sole question. A universal feeling, whether well or ill-founded, cannot be safely disregarded." Lincoln understood that the greatest challenge for a leader in a democratic society is to educate public opinion. "With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed, he said. Consequently, he who molds public sentiment goes deeper than he who enacts statutes or pronounces decisions. This statement goes to the heart of his disagreement with Douglas. When such an influential leader as Mary's Little Giant insisted that blacks were not included in the Declaration, he was molding public opinion and bending history in the wrong direction. "He is blowing out the moral lights around us," Lincoln warned, borrowing a phrase from his hero Henry Clay, "eradicating the light of reason and the love of liberty in this American people." Lincoln's goal was to rekindle those very beacons, constantly affirming the revolutionary promises made in the Declaration. When the authors of the Declaration spoke of equality, Lincoln insisted, they did not mean to assert the obvious untruth that all were then actually enjoying that equality. They meant to set up a standard maxim for free society, which should be familiar to all and revered by all, constantly looked to, constantly labored for, and even though never perfectly attained, constantly approximated, and thereby constantly spreading and deepening its influence, and augmenting the happiness and value of life to all people of all colors everywhere. He hoped to penetrate the human soul, until, as he said, all this quibbling about this man and the other man, this race and that race and the other race being inferior, could be discarded, until all Americans could unite as one people throughout this land, providing true meaning to the phrase, "All men are created equal." His comments on race here and throughout the debates reveal a brooding quality, as if he was thinking aloud, balancing a realistic appraisal of the present with a cautious eye toward progress in the future. History demonstrates that Lincoln and his contemporaries were not overestimating the depth of racial bigotry in America. A century would pass before legal apartheid was outlawed in the South, before separate schools were deemed unconstitutional, before blacks were finally guaranteed the right to vote. Moreover, each of these steps toward what Frederick Douglass called the practical recognition of our equality met with fierce white resistance and were made possible only by the struggles of blacks themselves, forcing the issue upon largely hostile or indifferent whites. There is no way to penetrate Lincoln's personal feelings about race. There is, however, the fact that armies of scholars, meticulously investigating every aspect of his life, have failed to find a single act of racial bigotry on his part. Even more telling is the observation of Frederick Douglass, who had become a frequent public critic of Lincoln's during his presidency, that of all the men he had met, Lincoln was the first great man that I talked with in the United States freely, who in no single instance reminded me of the difference between himself and myself, of the difference of color. This remark takes on additional meaning when one realizes that Douglass had met dozens of celebrated abolitionists, including Wendell Phillips, William Lloyd Garrison, and Salmon Chase. Apparently, Douglass never felt with any of them, as he did with Lincoln, an entire freedom from popular prejudice against the colored race. The seventh and last debate took place at Alton, a town on the Mississippi River in southwest Illinois, before an audience Lincoln described as having strong sympathies southward by relationship, place of birth, and so on. By the middle of the day, the whole town was alive and stirring with large masses of human beings. Gustav Kerner, a leader of the German Americans, was among the throng that came to witness the show. More than 1,000 Douglass men, Kerner wrote, had chartered a boat to attend the Alton meeting, while Lincoln had come quietly down from Springfield with his wife that morning, unobserved. He was soon surrounded by a crowd of Republicans, but there was no parade or fuss. While Douglas, about noon, made his pompous entry, and soon afterwards the boat from St. Louis landed at the wharf, heralded by the firing of guns and the strains of martial music. When Kerner reached Lincoln's hotel, he found him seated in the lobby. No sooner had they said hello than Lincoln suggested that they go together to see Mary. Apparently, Mary was rather dispirited about his chances for victory, and Lincoln hoped that Kerner would lift her mood. Kerner told Mary that he was certain the Republicans would carry the state and the popular vote, and tolerably certain about carrying the legislature. Although there was little new in the Alton debate, Kerner believed that Lincoln's speech included some of the finest passages of all the speeches he ever made. The real issue, Lincoln argued, the issue that would continue long after the tongues of Judge Douglas and myself shall be silent, was the eternal struggle between right and wrong. The common right of humanity set against the divine right of kings. It is the same spirit that says, "You work and toil and earn bread, and I'll eat it." No matter in what shape it comes, whether from the mouth of a king who seeks to bestride the people of his own nation and live by the fruit of their labor, or from one race of men as an apology for enslaving another race, it is the same tyrannical principle. With this, Lincoln took his seat. Douglas made his concluding remarks, and the great debates came to an end. In this race, as in all others, Lincoln was his own political manager. He drew up for his supporters a detailed battle plan, examining every district in the state and listing those he regarded as lost, those we take to ourselves, and those to be struggled for. Between his speeches, he drafted letters of instruction to key supporters, telling Kerner, for example, "We are in great danger in Madison. It is said half the Americans are going for Douglas. Nothing must be left undone. Elsewhere, things look reasonably well. Please write me." Though Eastern Republicans stayed out of the race, Chase came to Illinois to stump for the Republican ticket. He believed that Lincoln was a man who could be trusted on the anti-slavery issue, while at the same time he recognized that the prairie lawyer could be helpful to him in the upcoming presidential convention. More clearly than Seward or Greeley, Chase saw from the start that Douglas would never truly stand with the anti-slavery forces. For 8 days, traveling to Chicago, Galena, Warren, Rockford, and Mendota, Chase spoke to thousands on behalf of Lincoln and the Republican ticket in Illinois, a gesture Lincoln would not forget. It was a dreary day, November 2, 1858, when the voters of Illinois went to the polls. The names of Lincoln and Douglas did not appear on the ballots, since the state legislature would choose the next senator. That evening, Lincoln anxiously awaited the returns with his friends in the telegraph office. Once again, he would be sorely disappointed. Though the Republicans had won the popular vote, the Democrats had retained control of the state legislature, thereby ensuring Douglas's re-election. Lincoln's supporters were disconsolate and angry, blaming an unfair apportionment scheme. Kerner charged that, by the gerrymandering, the state's 700 Democratic votes were equal to 1,000 Republican votes. Republicans in Illinois bewailed the lack of support from Eastern Republicans and bitterly resented a last-minute intervention by the respected Whig leader and Kentucky Senator John Crittenden, who had penned a series of highly publicized letters to Illinois urging old Whigs and American supporters to vote for Douglas to repay his Lecompton stance. "Thousands of Whigs dropped us just on the eve of the election through the influence of Crittenden," Herndon complained. 2 days later, still feeling the sting of his defeat, Lincoln wrote Crittenden. He suppressed his justifiable resentment, exhibiting, as he had with Greeley and earlier with Trumbull and Judd, a magnanimity rare in the world of politics. The emotions of defeat, at the close of a struggle in which I felt more than a merely selfish interest, and to which defeat the use of your name contributed largely, are fresh upon me, he told Crittenden. But even in this mood, I cannot for a moment suspect you of anything dishonorable. Yet this defeat left Lincoln far less disheartened than his loss 4 years earlier. He had won the vote of the people. The ambition he had outlined in his very first public address at the age of 23, to render himself worthy of his fellow citizens' esteem, had been realized. I am glad I made the late race, he wrote his Springfield friend, Dr. Anson Henry, on November 19th. It gave me a hearing on the great and durable question of the age, which I could have had in no other way. I believe I have made some marks which will tell for the cause of civil liberty long after I am gone. That cause, he vowed to Henry Ashbury, must not be surrendered at the end of 1 or even 100 defeats. There was no reason for despondency, he told another friend, Dr. Charles Ray, who continued to brood over Lincoln's defeat. You will soon feel better. Another blow-up is coming, and we shall have fun again. Chapter 7 Countdown to the Nomination. As 1859 opened, Lincoln remained guardedly optimistic about the future, knowing he had run a solid campaign for the Senate and made a good name for himself. Well aware that he had only an outside chance at the presidential nomination in 1860, he nevertheless worked to build his reputation nationally. He was always careful to conceal his ambitions. Whenever he was asked about the upcoming election, he would speak with well-modulated enthusiasm of other candidates. Yet all his actions were consistent with a cautious and politically skillful pursuit of the nomination. Indeed, no other period in his pre-presidential life better illustrates his consummate abilities as a politician. Unlike Seward, he had no experienced political manager to guide his efforts. He would have to rely on himself, as he had from his early days on the frontier, and throughout his career as shopkeeper, lawyer, and politician. A month earlier, Jesse Fell, secretary of the Illinois Republican State Central Committee, had expressed his decided impression, in a letter to Lincoln, that Lincoln's tremendous fight against Douglas had given him a national platform. If the details of his early life and his efforts on the slavery question could be sufficiently brought before the people, he could be made a formidable, if not a successful, candidate for the presidency. Skeptical, Lincoln noted that Seward and Chase and others were so much better known. With an equivocal modesty, he asked, "Is it not, as a matter of justice, due to such men who have carried this movement forward to its present status in spite of fearful opposition, personal abuse, and hard names? I really think so." As for a campaign biography, he curtly answered, "There is nothing in my early history that would interest you or anybody else." Although refusing to confuse flattery with fact, he recognized nonetheless that Fell's argument had force. Lincoln's gradually evolving political strategy began with an awareness that while each of his three rivals had first claim on a substantial number of delegates, if he could position himself as the second choice of those who supported each of the others, he might pick up votes if one or another of the top candidates faltered. As a dark horse, he knew it was important not to reveal his intentions too early, so as to minimize the possibility of opponents mobilizing against him. On April 16, 1859, when the Republican editor of the Rock Island Register proposed to call on other editors to make a simultaneous announcement of your name for the presidency, Lincoln replied, "I certainly am flattered and gratified that some partial friends think of me in that connection. But I really think it best for our cause that no concerted efforts, such as you suggest, should be made. He added that he must, in candor, say, I do not think myself fit for the presidency. By fit, the self-confident Lincoln meant only to suggest that he did not necessarily have the credentials or experience appropriate to the office, not that he lacked the ability. It was important that any efforts on his behalf be squelched until the timing was right. And Lincoln, as would be evidenced throughout his presidency, was a master of timing. While Lincoln moved carefully, step by step, Seward, Chase, and even Bates had grown so eager for the presidential nomination that they made a number of costly errors as they headed down the final stretch. In the crucial months before the nomination, Seward, at Weed's rare misguided suggestion, took an extended tour of Europe, certain that Seward had the nomination locked up, so long as he refrained from the radical statements that frightened more moderate elements of the party. Weed recommended that his protege remove himself from the increasingly contentious debate at home by traveling overseas for 8 months. All our discreet friends unite in sending me out of the country to spend the recess of Congress, Seward joked. 14-year-old Fanny Seward, at home with her mother, was desolate at the prospect of an 8-month separation from her father. In the days before his ship was set to sail from New York, she could think of nothing else, she confided in her diary, but his approaching departure. An intelligent, plain girl, Fanny had been encouraged from an early age to read broadly and to write. Beyond her daily journal, she tried her hand at poetry and plays, determined, she once vowed, never to marry, so that she could live at home and devote herself to a literary career. While extremely close to her mother, a relationship she described as my affinity, with whom I think instead of speak, she idolized her father. The night before he left for Europe, she could barely contain her tears. In Europe, Seward was entertained by politicians and royalty alike, who assumed that he would be the next president. He met with Queen Victoria, Lord Palmerston, William Gladstone, King Victor Emmanuel of Italy, King Leopold I of Belgium, and Pope Pius IX. Moving from one dazzling social occasion to the next, Seward was ebullient. His letters home revealed the great pleasure he took in his sojourn, which carried him to Egypt and the Holy Land. Yet in the countdown to the presidential nomination, 8 months was a critical absence. Upon his return to Washington for the new congressional session that began after the new year in 1860, Seward took Weed's advice and prepared a major address. Designed to reassure Northern conservatives and moderate Southerners that he was a man who could be trusted to hold the Union together, the speech was to be delivered on the Senate floor on February 29, 1860. The reporter, Henry Stanton, later recalled that Seward showed it to him beforehand and asked him to write it up for the New York Tribune with an accompanying description of the scene in the Senate chamber as he was speaking. The description was elaborate, Stanton claimed, the senator himself suggesting some of the nicer touches, and every line of it was written and on its way to New York before Mr. Seward had uttered a word in the Senate chamber. Seward was in buoyant spirits, assuring Stanton that with this speech they would go down to posterity together. Frances Seward was less enthusiastic, perhaps fearing that her husband would bend too far to placate the moderates. "I wish it were over," she told her son Will on the morning of the speech. Fanny, however, seated in the gallery directly opposite her father, was thrilled to witness the great event. "The whole House of Reps were there," she gushed. "The gallery soon filled, alike with those of North and South, ladies and gentlemen, even the doorways were filled." When the 3-hour speech started, Fanny recorded, no Republican member left his seat. The House was very still. Everyone understood that this speech could influence the Republican nomination. Seward took as his theme the enduring quality of the national compact. Though he maintained his principled opposition to slavery, he softened his tone, referring to the slave states as capital states, while the free states became the labor states. His language remained tranquil throughout, with no trace of the inflammatory phrases that had characterized his great speeches in the past. It seemed, one historian observed, that the irrepressible conflict between slavery and freedom had graciously given way to the somewhat repressible conflict of the political aspirants. Departing from the bold assertions of his Rochester speech, Seward now claimed that differences of opinion, even on the subject of slavery, with us are political, not social or personal differences. There is not one disunionist or disloyalist among us all. We have never been more patient, and never loved the representatives of other sections more than now. The people of the North are not enemies, but friends and brethren of the South, faithful and true, as in the days when death has dealt his arrows promiscuously among them on the common battlefields of freedom. The Republican Party in the North, he pledged, did not seek to force or even to intrude our system upon the South. You are sovereign on the subject of slavery within your own borders. The debate revolved only around the expansion of slavery in new and future states. Retreating from the larger vision of the nation's future manifest destiny in some of his earlier speeches, he promised that Republicans did not harbor any ulterior motive to introduce Negro equality in the nation at large. Seward's powerful conclusion, an altered form of which would appear in Lincoln's inaugural address, was an impassioned testimony to the Union. The nation could never be sundered, for its bonds were not simply the written compact, or even the radiating network of roads, train tracks, trade routes, and telegraph lines that facilitated commerce and social intercourse. Rather, Seward urged his audience to conceive of the strongest bonds holding the Union together as the millions of fibers of millions of contented, happy human hearts, linked by affection and hope to their democratic government. The first, the last, and the only such one that has ever existed, which takes equal heed always of their wants. The speech produced deafening applause in the galleries and widespread praise in the press. Reprinted in pamphlet form, more than 500,000 copies were circulated throughout the country. Some, of course, considered Seward's tone too conciliatory, lacking the principle and fire of his previous addresses. That speech killed Seward with me forever, the abolitionist Cassius Clay reportedly said. Charles Sumner wrote to a friend that, as an intellectual effort, Seward's oration was most eminent, but that there was one passage, perhaps the one disclaiming any intention to support black equality, which he regretted, and Seward's wife agrees with me. Nevertheless, Seward's goal had not been to rally the faithful, but to disarm the opposition and placate uneasy moderates. From the standpoint of radical abolitionism, it would be very easy to criticize, Frederick Douglass observed in his monthly paper, but it is a masterly and triumphant effort. It will reassure the timid wing of his party, which has been rendered a little nervous by recent clamors against him, by its coolness of temper and conservatism of manner. We think that Mr. Seward's prospects for the Chicago nomination will be essentially brightened by the wide circulation of this speech. Seward, he concluded, was the ablest man of his party, and, as a matter of party justice, he deserved the nomination. I hear of ultra-old Whigs in Boston who say they are ready to take up Mr. Seward upon his recent speech, a Massachusetts delegate told Weed. All the New England delegates, save Connecticut's, will be equally satisfactory. And in Ohio, Salmon Chase admitted that there seems to be at present a considerable set towards Seward. Seward himself believed that the speech had been a great success, the final step in his long journey to the presidency. In the heady weeks that followed, Weed assured him that everything was in readiness for a victory at the convention. By trading legislative charters to build city railroads for campaign contributions, Weed had assembled what one observer called oceans of money, a campaign chest worth several $100,000. As the convention approached, overconfidence reigned in the Seward camp, and poor judgment set in. Despite Weed's generally keen political intuition, he failed to anticipate the damage Seward would suffer as a consequence of a rift with Horace Greeley. Over the years, Greeley had voiced a longing for political office, for both the monetary compensation it would provide and the prestige it promised. On several occasions, Greeley later claimed, he had made this desire clear to Seward and Weed. They never took his political aspirations seriously, believing that his strength and usefulness lay in writing, not in practical politics and public office. Greeley had written a plaintive letter to Seward in the autumn of 1854, in which he catalogued a long list of grievances and announced the dissolution of the political firm of Seward, Weed, and Greeley. He recalled the work he had done to secure Seward's first victory as governor, only to discover that jobs had been dispensed worth $3,000 to $20,000 per year to your friends and compatriots, and I returned to my garret and my crust and my desperate battle with pecuniary obligations. With the exception of a single term in Congress, Greeley charged, Weed had never given him a chance to be nominated for any office. Despite hundreds of suggestions that he run for governor in the most recent election, Weed had refused to support the possibility, claiming that his candidacy would hurt Seward's chances for the Senate. But the most humiliating moment had come, Greeley revealed, when Weed handed the nomination for lieutenant governor that year to Henry Raymond, editor of the New York Times, the Tribune's arch-rival. Seward was distressed to read Greeley's letter, which he characterized as full of sharp, pricking thorns. But he mistakenly assumed that Greeley's pique was temporary, akin to the anger, he said, that one of his sons might display if denied the chance to go to the circus or a dancing party. After showing it to his wife, Seward cast the letter aside. Francis read it more accurately. Recognizing the mortal offense Greeley had taken, she saved the letter, preserving a record of the tangled web of emotions that led Greeley in 1860 to abandon one of his oldest friends in favor of Edward Bates, a man he barely knew. Week after week, through his columns in the Tribune, Greeley laid the groundwork for the nomination of Bates. Seward's supporters were incensed when he subtly began to sabotage the New Yorker's campaign. Henry Raymond remarked that Greeley insinuated, rather than openly uttered, exaggerations of local prejudice and animosity against him, hints that parties and men hostile to him and to the Republican organization must be conciliated and their support secured, and a newborn zeal for nationalizing the party by consulting the slaveholding states in regard to the nomination. The influence of the Tribune was substantial, and with each passing day, enthusiasm for Bates's candidacy grew. At some point that spring, Weed had a long talk with Greeley and came away with the mistaken conviction that Greeley was all right, that despite his editorial support for Bates, he would not play a major role at the convention. The conversation mistakenly satisfied Weed that ties of old friendship would keep Greeley from taking an active role against Seward once the convention began. Overconfidence also played a role in Weed's failure to meet with Pennsylvania's powerful political boss, Simon Cameron, before the convention opened. In mid-March, Cameron told Seward that he wanted to see Weed in either Washington or Philadelphia at any time convenient to Weed. Seward relayed the message to his mentor, but Weed, certain that Cameron would deliver Pennsylvania to Seward by the second ballot, as he thought he had promised, never managed to make the trip. Weed's faith in Cameron was due partly to Seward's report of a special visit he had made to Cameron's estate, Lochiel, near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Shortly before leaving for Europe the previous spring, Seward had spent a day with Cameron and had returned certain that Cameron was pledged to his candidacy. "He took me to his home, told me all was right," Seward told Weed. "He was for me, and Pennsylvania would be. It might want to cast a first ballot for him, or might not. He brought the whole legislature of both parties to see me, feasted them gloriously, and they were in the main so free, so generous, as to embarrass me." Reports of this lavish reception persuaded reporters and politicians alike that a deal had been brokered. In the months that followed, even as gossip spread that Cameron did not have control of his entire delegation, Weed continued to believe that the Pennsylvania boss, so like himself in many ways, would do whatever was necessary to fulfill his pledge and deliver his state. After all, to Cameron was attributed the oft-quoted definition, "An honest politician is one who, when he is bought, stays bought." Cameron had been quicker than Weed to exploit the lucrative potential of politics. Through contracts with canal companies, railroads, and banks, he amassed so much money, he later boasted, that he might have become the richest man in Pennsylvania had he not pursued elective office. Unlike Weed, who remained behind the scenes, Cameron secured for himself two terms in the U.S. Senate, in 1844 and again in 1855. He began his political life as a Democrat, but became frustrated by Democratic positions on slavery and, more important, on the tariff, which was his legislative child. In 1855, he was instrumental in establishing Pennsylvania's Republican Party, initially called the People's Party. At the People's Party State Convention in February 1860, Cameron received the expected favorite son nod for the presidency, but Andrew Curtin, a magnetic young politician who was challenging Cameron for control in the state, was nominated for governor. Though Cameron received a majority vote at the convention, a substantial number of district delegates remained to be chosen, eventually producing a split between the rival forces of Cameron and Curtin. Curtin was uncommitted to any candidate when the Republican convention opened, yet it was known that he questioned Seward's electability. Seward's name on the ticket might hamstring his own election, for the anti-Catholic know-nothings, who still exerted considerable power in Pennsylvania, had never forgiven Seward for his liberalism toward immigrants and his controversial support for parochial education. Boss Cameron might have been able to resolve these obstacles with Boss Weed in private conversation before the convention. Since that meeting never took place, Weed was left to navigate the countervailing forces of the Pennsylvania state delegation without Cameron's guidance. Seward's leisurely sojourn abroad afforded Chase the opportunity to actively secure pledges and workers for his nomination. Never the most astute of politicians, Chase made curiously little use of the precious months of 1859 to better his chances. Sure of the power and depth of his support, he once again, as in 1856, assumed he would somehow gain the nomination without much personal intervention. News to the contrary, Chase dismissed out of hand, even when the intelligence came from his close friend, Gamaliel Bailey. Bailey and Chase had become acquainted in Cincinnati when Bailey was editing The Philanthropist. Later on, when Bailey became publisher of The National Era and moved his family to Washington, they warmly welcomed the lonely Chase into their home. When the Senate was in session, Chase lived for months at a time at their house, forming friendships with Bailey's wife, Margaret, and the entire Bailey clan. On Saturday evenings, The Baileys' home became a salon in European tradition, replete with dinner and the word games at which Chase excelled. Throughout their long friendship, Bailey had always been frank with Chase, castigating him in 1856 for his temporizing attitude toward the detestable know-nothings. Nonetheless, Bailey remained loyal and supportive of his old friend, assuring him on numerous occasions that he would rather see him in the presidential chair than any other man. Yet, as Bailey assessed the temper of the country in early 1859, conversing with many people, observing the signs of the times and the phases of public opinion, he concluded in a long, candid letter to Chase that he thought it best to support Seward in 1860. The time for Chase would come again 4 years later. "He and you are the two most prominent representative men of the party," Bailey wrote on January 16, 1859, "but he is older than you." His friends believe it is now or never with him. To postpone him now is to postpone him forever. You are in the prime of life and have the promise of continuing so. You have not attained your full stature or status. He has. Every year adds to your strength, and in 1864 you will be stronger than in 1860. To be urgent now against the settled feeling of Seward's numerous friends would provoke unpleasant and damaging discords, and tend hereafter to weaken your position. Bailey suspected that Chase might disagree with his recommendation, but, "I know you will not question my integrity or my friendship." "I do not doubt your friendship," Chase testily replied, "but I do think that if our situations were reversed, I should take a different method of showing mine for you. The suggestion, now or never, with regard to Seward, is babyish. How ridiculous! But to sum up all in brief, let me say it cannot change my position. I have no right to do so. A very large body of the people, embracing not a few who would hardly vote for any man other than myself as a Republican nominee, seem to desire that I shall be a candidate in 1860. No effort of mine, and as far as I know none of my immediate personal friends, has produced this feeling. It seems to be of spontaneous growth." Bailey responded that he presumed Chase's characterization of the now-or-never position of Seward's supporters as babyish was a slip of your pen. "It may be erroneous, groundless, but it is entitled to consideration. It has reference not only to age and health, but other matters. Governor Seward will be 59 in May 1860. Should another be nominated and elected, the chances would be in favor of a renomination, which would postpone the governor 8 years, until he should be 67, in the shadow of 70. You are still growing." Chase had just turned 51. "You are still increasing in reputation. 4 years hence, your chances of nomination and election to the presidency would be greater than they are now." Bailey assured Chase that he would never work against him. "All I desired was to apprise you as a friend." Deluded by flattery, Chase preferred the unrealistic projections of New York's Hiram Barney, who thought his strength in New York State was growing so rapidly that it was possible he might receive New York's vote on the first ballot. So heroic was his self-conception, Chase believed that doubtful supporters would flock to his side once they understood the central role he had played as the guardian of the anti-slavery tradition and father of the Republican Party. Failing once again to appoint a campaign manager, Chase had no one to bargain and maneuver for him, no one to promise government posts in return for votes. He rejected an appeal from a New Hampshire supporter who proposed to build a state organization. He never capitalized on the initial support of powerful Chicago Press and Tribune editor Joseph Medill. He turned down an invitation to speak at Cooper Union in a lecture series organized by his supporters as a forum for candidates other than Seward. refusing even to consider that his own state might deny him a united vote on the first ballot, he failed to confirm that every delegate appointed to the convention was pledged to vote for him. Indeed, his sole contribution to his own campaign was a series of letters to various supporters and journalists around the country, reminding them that he was the best man for the job. Frustrated supporters tried to shake him into more concerted action. "I now begin to fear that Seward will get a majority of the delegates from Maryland," Chase's loyal backer, James Ashley, warned. "He and his friends work. Work. They not only work, but he works." The willful Chase was blind to troubling signs, convinced that if the delegates voted their conscience, he would ultimately prevail. "I shall have nobody to push or act for me at Chicago," Chase boasted to Benjamin Eggleston, a delegate from Cincinnati, "except the Ohio delegation, who will, I doubt not, faithfully represent the Republicans of the state." While a large majority of the Ohio state delegation indeed supported Chase, Senator Ben Wade had his own devoted followers. "The Ohio delegation does not seem to be anywhere as yet," Delegate Erastus Hopkins warned. Heedless, Chase remained positive that the entire Ohio delegation would come around, given everything he had done and sacrificed for his state. To support any other candidate would put one in a position no man of honor or sensibility would care to occupy. A month before the convention, Kate convinced her father that a journey to Washington would shore up his support among various congressmen and senators. Lodging at the Willard Hotel, they made the rounds of receptions and dinners. Seward was very kind to them, Chase admitted to his friend James Briggs. The genial New Yorker hosted a dinner party in their honor, at which all sides were pretty fairly represented, and there was a good deal of joking. The next evening, former Ohio Congressman John Gurley organized a party to honor both Chase and Ohio's new governor, William Dennison. Seward was invited to join the Ohio gathering, which included former Whig leader Tom Corwin and Senator Ben Wade. Writing home after the dinner, Seward joshingly noted that he found much comfort in the discovery that Ohio was home to at least three candidates for the presidency, all eminent and excellent men, but each preferring anybody out of Ohio to his two rivals within. While Seward immediately intuited signals that Ben Wade, in particular, coveted the nomination, Chase remained oblivious, refusing to believe that Ohio would not back its most deserving son. On the Chase's last evening in Washington, the Blairs threw them a lavish party at their country estate in Silver Spring. As usual, Kate left a deep impression on everyone. Seward afterward told Frances that she was quite a young lady, pleasant and well-cultivated. Chase wrote Nettie how pleased he was that many showed attention to Katie, and many were kind to me. He returned home convinced that his trip had accomplished a great deal. "Everybody seems to like me and to feel a very gratifying degree of confidence in me," he reported to a Cincinnati friend. Confusing hospitality with hard allegiance, he told one of his supporters that a great change seemed to come over men's minds while I was in Washington. The beginning of the pre-presidential year found the backers of Edward Bates more active in the pursuit of his nomination than the candidate himself. While Bates would gradually warm to the idea, he found himself, as always, conflicted about plunging into politics. Without the encouragement of the powerful Blairs, it is unlikely that he would have put his name forward. Once he agreed to stand, he was confronted with a political dilemma. His strength lay among old Whigs and nativists concentrated in the border states and conservatives in the North and Northwest. To have a genuine chance for the nomination, he would have to prove himself acceptable to moderate Republicans as well. Had he used the months prior to the nomination to travel to the very different states of Illinois, Indiana, Massachusetts, Connecticut, or Maryland, he might have acquainted himself with the wide range of views that comprised the new party. But he never left his home state, preferring to rely on intelligence received from colleagues and supporters who came to visit him. Not only did he keep to Missouri, he rarely left his beloved home, noting in his diary when he was forced to stay overnight in St. Louis that it was the first that I have slept in town for about 2 years. 4 decades of marriage had not diminished his bond with Julia. Secluding himself at home, Bates never developed a clear understanding of the varied constituencies that had to be aligned, a deficit that resulted in a number of missteps. While his distance from the fierce arguments of the 50s was considered beneficial to his candidacy, his long absence from politics made him less familiar with the savage polarization created by the slavery issue. In late February 1859, he answered the request of the Whig Committee of New York for his views and opinions on the politics of the country. The New York Whigs had passed a resolution calling for an end to agitation of the Negro question so that the country might focus on topics of general importance, such as economic development and internal improvements, that would unite rather than fracture the nation. In his letter, which was published nationwide, Bates declared that he had always considered the Negro question to be a pestilent question, the agitation of which has never done good to any party, section, or class, and never can do good unless it be accounted good to stir up the angry passions of men and exasperate the unreasoning jealousy of sections. He believed that those who continued to press the issue after the sorrowful experience of the last few years must be motivated by personal ambition or sectional prejudice. Lauded by Whigs and nativists, the letter provoked widespread criticism in Republican circles. Schuyler Colfax, who backed Bates for president, warned him that his comments denouncing the agitation of the Negro question sounded like a denunciation of the Republican Party and would turn many against him. Bates disagreed. If my letter had been universally acceptable to the Republicans, that fact alone might have destroyed my prospects in 2 frontier slave states, Maryland and Missouri, and so I would have no strength at all but the Republican Party, where Seward and Chase, he knew, were far better positioned. Maryland Congressman Henry Winter Davis, the leading member of the American Party in the House, confirmed Bates's views, advising him that he was poised to secure majority approval and should not attempt to further define his views. Write no more public letters. Let well enough alone. As the new year opened, Bates believed his chances were growing brighter every day. Supporters in the key battleground states of Indiana and Pennsylvania assured him that large percentages of the delegates appointed to the Chicago Convention were made up of Bates men. A visitor from Illinois told him that much good feeling existed in the southern part of the state, but first, on a point of state pride, they must support Lincoln. This was the first time in his daily entries that Bates so much as mentioned Lincoln's name as a presidential aspirant. In Illinois, Lincoln was keenly aware of Bates, answering an inquiring letter about how Illinois regarded the various candidates by saying that Bates would be the best man for the south of our state and the worst for the north of it, while Seward was the very best candidate we could have for the north of Illinois and the very worst for the south of it. With amusing self-serving logic, Lincoln suggested that neither Bates nor Seward could command a majority vote in Illinois. On the last day of February 1860, the very day of Seward's conciliatory speech in the Senate, a great opposition convention, comprised of Whigs and Americans, met in Jefferson City, Missouri, and enthusiastically endorsed Bates for president. 2 weeks later, Bates received a second endorsement from the Republican State Convention in St. Louis. The Missouri Republicans, however, were in a carping mood, particularly the German-American contingent, which threatened to block the endorsement, still troubled by Bates's open support for the nativist party in 1856. To satisfy both the more ardent Republicans and the German-American community, Frank Blair suggested that Bates agree to outline his positions in answer to a questionnaire drawn up by the German-American press. The questionnaire posed a difficult problem for Bates. He had to assuage the doubts of Republicans, who felt, like editor Joseph Medill of Chicago, that it was better to be beaten with a representative man, who placed himself squarely on the Republican platform, than to triumph with a union saver and sink into the quicksands. However, if he moved too far to the left to satisfy the passionate Republicans, he would risk his natural base among the old Whigs and Americans. Though once noted for his deft touch in harmonizing opposing forces, Bates plunged into his answers without calculating the consequences. Asked to render his opinions on the extension of slavery into the territories, he announced that Congress had the power to decide the issue, a position that directly contradicted the Dred Scott decision. He felt, moreover, that the spirit and the policy of the government ought to be against its extension. He advocated equal constitutional rights for all citizens, native-born or naturalized, claiming to endorse no distinctions among American citizens, and adding that the government is bound to protect all the citizens in the enjoyment of all their rights everywhere. Beyond this, he favored colonizing former slaves in Africa and Central America, a Homestead Act, a Pacific Railroad, and the admission of Kansas as a free state. His statement met with approval in traditional Republican enclaves in the Northeast and Northwest, but in the border states, where his advantage was supposed to reside, it proved disastrous. The Lexington, Missouri Express wrote that the published letter came as a clap of thunder from a clear sky, placing Bates so blatantly in the black Republican camp that he should no longer expect support from the more conservative border states. By subscribing to every article of the Republican creed, the Louisville Journal complained, Bates became just as good or bad a Republican as Seward, Chase, or Lincoln is. He has, by a single blow, severed every tie of confidence or sympathy which connected him with the Southern conservatives. Only 4 years earlier, the Memphis Bulletin observed, Bates had denounced black Republicans as agitators, labeling them dangerous enemies to the peace of our Union. Now he had become one of them. Bates himself recognized the backlash his letter had created, lamenting the simultaneous abandonment of me by a good many papers in the border states. The attempt to pacify the anxious German Americans had diminished his hold on what should have been his natural base, without bringing a commensurate number of Republicans to his side. Though the Bates camp maintained faith that their man was bound to win the nomination, Bates confided in his diary that, knowing the fickleness of popular favor, and on what small things great events depend, I shall take care not so to set my heart upon the glittering bauble, as to be mortified or made at all unhappy by a failure. Not hindered by the hubris, delusions, and inconsistencies that plagued his three chief rivals, Abraham Lincoln gained steady ground through a combination of hard work, skill, and luck. While Seward and Bates felt compelled in the final months to reposition themselves toward the center of the party, Lincoln never changed his basic stance. He could remain where he had always been, neither on the left wing nor the right, but very close to dead center, as Don Fehrenbacher writes. From the time he had first spoken out against the extension of slavery into the territories, in the wake of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, Lincoln had insisted that while the spread of slavery must be fairly headed off, he had no wish to interfere with slavery where it already existed. So long as the institution was contained, which Lincoln considered a sacred pledge, it was in course of ultimate extinction. This position represented perfectly the views of the moderate majority in the Republican Party. Though a successful bid for the nomination remained unlikely, a viable candidacy was no longer an impossible dream. Slowly and methodically, Lincoln set out to improve his long odds. He arranged to publish his debates with Douglas in a book that was read widely by Republicans. As more and more people became familiar with him through the newspaper stories of the debates, invitations to speak at Republican gatherings began to pour in. Not yet an avowed candidate, Lincoln delivered nearly 24 speeches in Iowa, Ohio, Wisconsin, Indiana, and Kansas in the 4 months between August and December 1859. While Seward was still touring Europe and the Middle East, Lincoln was introducing himself to tens of thousands of Westerners. "I think it is a mistake," a leading New Yorker wrote Lincoln, "that Senator Seward is not on his own battlefield, instead of being in Egypt surveying the route of an old underground railroad over which Moses took one day a whole nation from bondage into liberty." Lincoln capitalized on Seward's absence. The crowds that greeted him grew with every stop along the way. Most of his audiences had never laid eyes on him, and he invariably forged an indelible impression. Once he began speaking, the Janesville Gazette reported, "the high order of his intellect left a permanent impact upon his listeners, who would remember his tall, gaunt form, and his points and his hits, for many a day." Speaking not as a candidate but as an advocate for the Republican cause, Lincoln sharpened his attacks on the Democrats, and in particular on the party's front-runner, Stephen Douglas, who preceded him at many of the same locations. "Douglasism," he wrote Chase, "is all which now stands in the way of an early and complete success of Republicanism." In this way, ironically, Douglas's national reputation continually increased the attention paid to Lincoln. Perhaps Lincoln's most rewarding stop was Cincinnati, which he had vowed never again to visit after the humiliating Reaper trial. This time he was greeted with the thunder of cannon and strains of martial music and the joyous plaudits of thousands of citizens thronging the streets. He arrived at the Burnett House and was put up in princely style, delighted to find that the most prominent of Cincinnati's residents were vying to meet the rising star. Lincoln addressed the Southern threats that the election of a Republican president would divide the Union, directing his remarks particularly to the many Kentuckians who had crossed the Ohio River to listen to him. "Will you make war upon us and kill us all? Why, gentlemen, I think you are as gallant and as brave men as live, that you can fight as bravely in a good cause, man for man, as any other people living. But, man for man, you are not better than we are, and there are not so many of you as there are of us. You will never make much of a hand at whipping us. If we were fewer in numbers than you, I think that you could whip us. If we were equal, it would likely be a drawn battle. But, being inferior in numbers, you will make nothing by attempting to master us." The next day his speech was described in the Cincinnati Gazette as an effort remarkable for its clear statement, powerful argument, and massive common sense, and possessed of such dignity and power as to have impressed some of our ablest lawyers with the conclusion that it was superior to any political effort they had ever heard. Lincoln's crowded schedule allowed him no time to accept Joshua Speed's invitation to visit him in Kentucky for the opening of the National Racecourse. When, his old friend promised, "we expect to have some of the best horses in America to compete for the purses. In addition, we think we can show the prettiest women," adding, "if you are not too old to enjoy either the speed of the horses or the beauty of the women, come." If his speaking tour caused Lincoln to forego speedy horses and beautiful women, it greatly increased his stature among Western Republicans. "Your visit to Ohio has excited an extensive interest in your favor," former Congressman Samuel Galloway told him. "We must take some man not hitherto corrupted with the discussion upon candidates. Your name has been again and again mentioned. I am candid to say you are my choice." Rapidly becoming a national spokesman for the fledgling Republican Party, Lincoln sought to preserve the unity of the still fragile coalition. He wished, he wrote Schuyler Colfax, to hedge against divisions in the Republican ranks. An anti-immigrant movement in Massachusetts failed to see that tilting against foreigners would ruin us in the whole Northwest. While attempts in both Ohio and New Hampshire to thwart enforcement of the fugitive slave law might utterly overwhelm us in Illinois with the charge of enmity to the Constitution itself. In a word, in every locality we should look beyond our noses and at least say nothing on points where it is probable we shall disagree. Colfax appreciated Lincoln's kind and timely note, which underscored the need to enlist in the Republican cause men of all shades and gradations of opinion, from the conservative to the bold radical. To be victorious in 1860, he wrote, "we must either win this conservative sentiment, with its kindred sympathizers, represented under the title of North Americans, Old Line Whigs, etc., to our banners, without alienating the radicals, or, by repelling them, must go into the contest looking for defeat." "In this cause of unity," Colfax assured Lincoln, "your counsel carries great weight. There is no political letter that falls from your pen which is not copied throughout the Union." Lincoln's ability to bridge these divisions would prove of vital importance to his campaign. On October 16, 1859, as Lincoln prepared for a trip to Kansas, the remaining bonds of union were strained almost to the point of rupture when the white abolitionist John Brown came to Virginia, in the words of Stephen Vincent Benet, with foolish pikes and a pack of desperate boys to shadow the sun. Brown and his band of 13 white men and 5 blacks seized the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, with a bold but ill-conceived plan of provoking a slave insurrection. The arsenal was swiftly recaptured, and Brown taken prisoner by a federal force under the command of Colonel Robert E. Lee, accompanied by Lieutenant J.E.B. Stewart. Brown was tried and sentenced to death. "I am waiting the hour of my public murder with great composure of mind and cheerfulness," Brown wrote his family, "feeling the strongest assurance that in no other possible way could I be used to so much advance the cause of God and of humanity." In the month between the sentence and his hanging, the dignity and courage of his conduct and the eloquence of his statements and letters made John Brown a martyr hero to many in the anti-slavery North. His death, when it came, was mourned by public assemblies throughout the northern states. Church bells tolled, the historian David Potter writes, black bunting was hung out, minute guns were fired, prayer meetings assembled, and memorial resolutions were adopted. Brown's motivations, psychological profile, and strategy would be probed by historians, poets, and novelists for generations. The immediate impact of the intrepid raid, which sent a shiver of fear to the inmost fiber of every white man, woman, and child in the South, was unmistakable. While anti-slavery fervor in the North was intensified, Southern solidarity and rhetoric reached a new level of zealotry. Harper's Ferry, wrote the Richmond Inquirer, coupled with the expression of Northern sentiment in support, have shaken and disrupted all regard for the Union, and there are but few men who do not look to a certain and not distant day when dissolution must ensue. The raid at Harper's Ferry, one historian notes, was like a great meteor disclosing in its lurid flash the width and depth of that abyss which cut the nation in two. Herman Melville, in his poem The Portent, would use the same metaphor, calling Weird John Brown the meteor of the war, the tail of his long beard trailing out from under the executioner's cap. Throughout the South, heightened fear of slave insurrection led to severe restrictions on the expression of anti-slavery sentiments. I do not exaggerate in designating the present state of affairs in the Southern country as a reign of terror, the British consul in Charleston wrote. Persons are torn away from their residences and pursuits. Letters are opened at the post offices. Discussion upon slavery is entirely prohibited under penalty of expulsion. The Northern merchants and travelers are leaving in great numbers. In Norfolk, Virginia, the St. Louis News reported, a grand jury indicted a merchant for seditious language because he declared that John Brown was a good man fighting in a good cause. Leading Southern politicians were quick to indict the Republican Party, and by extension, the entire North. The Tennessee legislature resolved that the raiders at Harper's Ferry were the natural fruits of this treasonable, irrepressible conflict doctrine put forth by the great head of the Black Republican Party and echoed by his subordinates. A man representing 100 gentlemen published a circular that offered a $50,000 reward for the head of William H. Seward, along with the considerably smaller sum of $25 for the heads of a long list of traitors, including Sumner, Greeley, Giddings, and Colfax. Lincoln was not included in the list of enemies. Democratic papers in the North joined in, targeting Seward for special condemnation. The first overt act in the great drama of national disruption, which has been plotted by that demagogue William H. Seward, has just closed at Harper's Ferry, the New York Herald charged. No reasoning man can fail to trace cause and effect between the bloody and brutal manifesto of William H. Seward, the irrepressible conflict speech a year earlier, and the terrible scenes of violence, rapine, and death that have been enacted at the confluence of the Potomac and the Shenandoah. Republicans, naturally, countered Democratic attempts to implicate their party. Seward himself stated that although Brown was a sympathetic figure, his execution was necessary and just. Weed's Albany Evening Journal also took a decided stance against the futile raid, deeming Brown's men guilty of treason for seeking to plunge a peaceful community into the horrors of a servile insurrection. They justly deserve universal condemnation. In Missouri, Bates concluded that the wild extravagance and utter futility of his plan proved that Brown was a madman. He discussed the incident at length with his young friend, Lieutenant J.E.B. Stewart, who had come to stay at Grape Hill for several days with his wife, Flora, his child, and two free black servants. "He tells me a good deal about old Brown," Bates wrote in his diary. "He was at his capture and has his dagger." For Chase, the situation presented particular problems. Though he publicly denounced Brown's violation of law and order, his younger daughter, Nettie, later conceded that for a household accustomed to revere as friends of the family such men as Sumner, Garrison, Wendell Phillips, Whittier, and Longfellow, it was impossible not to sympathize with the truly good old man who was about to die for others. She and her friends built a small fort in the conservatory and raised a flag on which was painted defiantly, "Freedom forever, slavery never." When friends warned Chase that such open support of Brown could not be countenanced, he had to explain to his daughter that a great wrong could not be righted in the way poor old John Brown had attempted to do. The little fort was dismantled. At the time of Brown's execution, on December 2, 1859, Lincoln was back on the campaign trail, telling an audience in Leavenworth, Kansas, that the attempt to identify the Republican Party with the John Brown business was an electioneering dodge. He wisely sought the middle ground between the statements of radical Republicans like Emerson, who believed that Brown's execution would make the gallows as glorious as the cross, and conservative Republicans who denounced Brown for his demented, traitorous scheme. He acknowledged that Brown had displayed great courage and rare unselfishness. Nonetheless, he concluded, that cannot excuse violence, bloodshed, and treason. It could avail him nothing that he might think himself right. When he returned from his canvassing, Lincoln focused on the approaching meeting of the Republican National Committee, to be held on December 21, 1859, at the Astor House in New York. Committee members from nearly all the free states were gathered to decide where the Republican convention would be held. Supporters of Seward, Chase, and Bates argued in turn that the convention should be placed in New York, Ohio, or Missouri. Though Lincoln had not yet committed himself publicly to run for the nomination, he wrote to Norman Judd, a member of the selection committee, to press the claims of Illinois, to satisfy friends who attach more consequence to the location than either he or Judd had originally done. Judd waited patiently as the claims of Buffalo, Cleveland, Cincinnati, St. Louis, Indianapolis, and Harrisburg were put forth. When no agreement could be reached, he shrewdly suggested Chicago as good neutral ground where everyone would have an even chance. Although Lincoln was known to most of the committee members at this point, none considered him a serious candidate for the presidency. Judd carefully kept old Abe out of sight, observed Henry Whitney, and the delegates failed to see any personal bearing the place of meeting was to have on the nomination. The choice finally narrowed down to St. Louis and Chicago. Judd promised that the members of the convention and all outsiders of the Republican faith should have a hospitable reception, that sufficient accommodations would be provided for feeding and lodging the large crowd, and that a hall for deliberation should be furnished free. Ultimately, Chicago beat St. Louis by a single vote.